Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk by meditation instructor Eric Weinberg begins with a few personal reflections, after which he continues our examination of the lives of the Karmapas. The sixth Karmapa, Tongwa Dondon, composed a great number of texts on rituals to establish a solid and consistent liturgical basis for the lineage and developed the reproduction and distribution of sacred texts. The seventh Karmapa, Chodrak Jamso, spent many years in retreat and was known for both skillful meditation and kind attentiveness to others. He emphasized the education of monks, development of philosophical teachings, dissemination of texts, and established a large college in Serpu, which achieved an unequaled reputation for the high standards of its teachings. Enjoy the podcast.
Before I start, I actually wanted to thank everybody for their prayers for me. For those of you who don't know, I had a full hip replacement 6 weeks ago Tuesday. And everything went really well. I mean, they had me up and walking actually the next day, because the surgery turned out to be in the afternoon. And it was just too late to have the PTs hang around by the time I woke up from all those good drugs they gave me. And I was discharged from the hospital the next day and went home. And I was able to go up and down steps within a couple weeks. And at this point, I can honestly say, you know, last time you saw me, I had a bad limp and a cane, and now I have neither. I stayed in what we call our guest room, which is on the first floor, so I didn't have to go up and down steps and all that. And I had... there's a little library in there, and I set up this little medicine Buddha shrine with a picture of Karmapa and a picture of Kempo Kartha Rinpoche. And so we just stared at each other a lot while I was laying in bed. And one of the clear ideas that came to me in all that was that I was recovering faster, way faster than I was led to believe I would. And, you know, I looked at my little shrine. I said, inquiring minds want to know. And they said, people are praying for you. That's what came. So I wanted to thank you. And I also wanted to say that it matters, you know, that we actually stop and, even the simplest thing, just simply dedicating the merit of appreciating something pretty on a walk, it's enough. It's very powerful. And so before I said anything about anything else today, I wanted to say that it was even to the point that, get this, I was scheduled to have the surgery on January 22nd. And then at 4 in the morning, I got a phone call from the hospital saying the surgery's off. Surgeons got the flu. I'd already been, you know, like, oh, it was a mess. It was like I had all this pain. And, of course, you start cutting back on supplements and pain medication and all that weeks before. So by the time this thing was rolled around, I was really ready. I was actually in a lot of pain. And they said, and I know what this guy's schedule's like, and I'm thinking, holy moly, I can't start him up again because then it's too close. And we don't know when it'll be. Gee, this is really rough. And I felt sorry for myself, right? And they rescheduled me for a week later, and which was great. And I did call them and bug them about it, which maybe was great and maybe wasn't. I feel like they were really, really swamped with all the rescheduling that had to happen. I'm very grateful that this guy didn't try to power through. That was another lesson. He accepted that he wasn't at his best, and he didn't want to operate on anybody when he wasn't at his best. And you and I both know we all try to power through sometimes when we shouldn't. And there are doctors who power through sometimes when they shouldn't. So I wrote him a little email, and I thanked him for his compassion for taking care of himself and at the same time taking care of everybody else. And he appreciated that. I think that may be why I got in 1 week later. Who knows? Sometimes interdependence, you know. And so a Facebook friend of mine, somebody who I don't think I've ever really met in person unless I met him at KTD a million years ago, wrote me, and he was looking at the Tibetan calendar. And he said he had heard I was supposed to have the surgery and it got canceled, rescheduled. And he said, "Oh, you're so fortunate." And I messaged him, "Why?" He said, "Well, I was looking at the Tibetan calendar," and he said, "the 22nd was an inauspicious day for any medical procedure." Now, how crazy is that? I mean, pretty crazy. So it happened a week later, and surgeon felt like he was having his best day. And so far, I've been a very boring patient. I have no dramas to report to you at all. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. So, this morning, we're continuing in this book, The History of the Karmapas. Has everybody here heard previous chapters out of this book? Anybody who hasn't? Okay. Well, let me just give a little brief introduction. The Karmapa, the current Karmapa, is that guy there. And what happens is the Buddhism we practice here is part of a lineage that goes back 1,200 years. And the lineage started with a great meditation master in India named Tilopa, who had profound realization. Then a guy named Naropa, who is like one of the deans of this great university in India called Nalanda, kind of had a moment where he realized that he knew everything there was to know. He'd read all the books. He had a grasp of all the books. He taught all the books. And he was really quite something. He was kind of a world-renowned scholar. But he, inside himself, realized that he had no realization. And that's what his deep desire was realization. So he left Nalanda. You know, it's kind of like if you're a professor and you leave a tenured position. That's kind of like that. It was a big leap for him. And he went to find this great meditation master who supposedly had realization named Tilopa, and he found him, and the guy didn't look like much. He was living in a box down by the river, literally, to quote an old Saturday Night Live skit. He didn't have any material finery about him. And he was grinding sesame seeds into oil, and that's how he made his living, making sesame oil. But Naropa somehow knew that he was the real deal. This is important. So you had this guy who was like a meditation master and this guy who was a great scholar, and they came together. And Tilopa passed the lineage on to Naropa. After Tilopa passed, a great farmer and householder in southern Tibet named Marpa Latsawa, who could translate Sanskrit, which was spoken in India at that time, into Tibetan, also got this hunger for realization. And so he left his farms and his family in the hands of family, and he went off on a long journey. And it was a difficult journey back then to walk from Tibet to India. And he went to find Naropa and found him. He ended up making 3 trips. And with each trip, he brought back more teachings to Tibet and translated them. He himself became a realized person. So now we've had a kind of street person, a scholar. Now we've got a householder, a farmer, landowner, and the teachings came to Tibet. There was this wild man named Milarepa. He was an angry young man because there was trauma in his family. Long story short, it was really rough. And, you know, people were killed and things like that. So he himself became vengeful and ended up causing the deaths of some relatives, which is a pretty black piece of karma right there. But he had some spiritual gifts. He did it through what's called magic, although who knows, right? And he himself became dissatisfied. With all his powers, he still wasn't satisfied, so he traveled to find Marpa. And he did, and Marpa recognized him somehow, that this guy should be the guy I pass lineage onto, which is crazy, because there's this young guy who'd done really bad things. And Marpa put him through a series of very, very difficult purification experiences, and in the process transmitted the whole lineage to him. And Milarepa went up to a cave and started meditating, and literally stayed in caves meditating the rest of his life, literally with nothing. If there was food, it was because he picked nettles. He was famous for picking nettles, making nettle tea. He drank so much nettle tea over the years, they say he turned green. And people would bring him food. He had a sister that would bring him food and so on and so forth. But he really didn't have much. What he had was a rock that he sat on to meditate. There was a physician named Gampopa after that. And Gampopa had a family. And even though he was a physician, his family all died, his wife and his children, in a plague. He was, you know, brokenhearted and became a monk, a Kadampa monk. And after learning the mind training, and obviously was extremely intelligent, physician kind of intelligence, and he also knew that there was more. And so he left the monastery and went and found Milarepa, and he became the inheritor of Milarepa's teachings. And then Gampopa had a student named Dusum Kempa. And Dusum Kempa absorbed the teachings and taught the teachings and established monasteries and was world-renowned at that time for all kinds of gifts and intelligence. And at the end of his life, he said he had taken the Bodhisattva vow. Some people here have taken that. The Bodhisattva vow is a vow to do no harm, not only not do harm, but also to continue to benefit beings no matter what, not just in this life, but in all your lives. So those who take the bodhisattva vow are saying, even if I had the chance to pass into nirvana beyond suffering, I'll go right to the very borderline, right to the limit, but I'll always come back. As long as they're suffering beings, I will always come back to benefit them. The bodhisattva vow, if you ever have the chance to take it, Lama Kathy gives it. If you go to KTD, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche gives it, do it. It's the heart of compassion. And really, there is no enlightenment without compassion. It's just the way it is, folks. So if you aspire to enlightenment, the bodhisattva vow is kind of a support and a help along that path. So he took that vow and he vowed to come back again and again. So at the end of his life, because he'd achieved such a high level, he kind of was clairvoyant. And he realized that he wouldn't get caught by his bad habits and desires in the state after death that's called the bardo, that he would be able to direct his mind according to his aspirations. He wrote down a letter and he said, I'm going to be born in such and such a family, in such and such a town, in such and such a place, and I'm going to continue this work of being a bodhisattva and benefiting beings. Come find me. And he gave this letter to his main student that he passed the lineage on to. And he became the first Karmapa. The second Karmapa, Karmapakshi, was the first infant that was discovered by one of these prediction letters. And now we're on the 17th. That's where we are. So the idea was, when we started this cycle of teachings, was each of these were, while they're all the same mind stream, they're like all of us in our mind streams, at least the parts we know about, we change and develop through our lives. And the mind stream of the Karmapa continues to just have amazing developments. We decided, wow, it'd be great to know who they are and what they did, and see how the lineage and how this mind stream that is, in fact, our inspiration and our leader has developed. So we've been doing this book. That's, yeah, relatively short synopsis. The history of the Karmapas. And today we're going to talk about two Karmapas. The sixth, Tongwa Donden, which means meaningful to behold, and the seventh, Chodrak Jamso, ocean of world renown. But before I begin, before all these talks, in order to just engender blessing in ourselves and for the whole group and for all the kids and people upstairs having a great party, and everybody else, we chant the refuge prayer. And we chant it three times, one for the benefit of all beings, another to connect us to the lineage, and the third to recognize that the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha, the three jewels we take refuge in, are in fact already within us. We're just here to take another step in the path of uncovering that so that we can realize who we actually are. So, for those of you who know the refuge prayer, please chant it along with me. For those of you who are unfamiliar with it, please just follow along in your heart with the idea that you and all sentient beings already have the nature of enlightenment within you. Mm-hmm. Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Chang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin Soki Pe Sonam Ki Rola Penchi Sanje Rupar Sho Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Jang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Gi Pe Sonam Gi Drola Penchi Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chudang So Ki Chognam La Jang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Gi Pe Sunam Gi Rula Enchi Sanje Drupar Sho. Thank you. I was looking around. We don't have lineage tanka up there. You can, there are things, you can go online and look for Karmakaju lineage tanka, and you can get a picture of how many enlightened beings you are personally connected to just by being here this morning. It's very simple and direct. It doesn't take any magical incantations to connect you to the lineage, and it's inspiring to see. And you can sink into the idea that all of these bodhisattvas have only one intention, which is that you pass beyond suffering and that you join them in benefiting all beings without exception. So Tongwa Donden was born in the spring of the eighth day of the second month of the fire monkey year, which was 1416 in terms of how we do years. He was born into a family of yogis in eastern Tibet, just as his predecessor, the fifth Karmapa, had predicted. The birth took place near Karmagun, which was the first monastery that was established by the first Karmapa. When he was a few months old, because, you know, there's signs and wonders and all that, the parents presented him, excuse me, to a lama from a nearby monastery. Do I remember his name? No. His name was Gompa Chaldrapa. And Gompa Chaldrapa had been a student of the fifth Karmapa's. And when the baby saw him, he got immediately happy. I don't think it was just gas. Any of you who had baby, you know this. But it apparently was more than that. He recognized him, the text says, and showed great joy. The lama was kind of surprised. Some of these guys are a little bit imposing, and not all babies react well to all of them. They're not all like Lama Karma, who some of you got to see last week. Some of them are a little bit more imposing. Anyway, so the baby grabbed him by the finger, and the text says, these babies talk, like when they're like 1 or 2 months old. We'll get to this a little more in a second. He said, and get what he said, I'm the unborn free of names and places. I've become the glory of all sentient beings to guide the beings without protection in this world towards liberation. That's a mouthful for me, let alone, some baby 2 months old. The baby then recited the vowels of the Sanskrit alphabet, which is an interesting thing. So I have a couple things to say about this. One is the vowels and consonants represent respectively the activities and the qualities. So put together in the right way, when you chant, there's multiple practices where you chant the vowels and consonants, and what you're doing is you're trying to engender enlightened activity and enlightened qualities. Karmapa means activity of the Buddha. So for him to recite the vowels is kind of like he's saying, yeah, that's me in the story. The other thing is, it's weird when you read through these. I hope you read through these. These babies and kids up to the point of their taking vows, really, do all kinds of miraculous little things right from birth. And then when they become karmapas, it quiets down. As they become more powerful, they do less woo-woo stuff, which is very interesting. I think they aim their minds, their energies, rather than towards, making rainbows or something like that. Rather than do that, they actually get involved in really important work for the lineage and for the world. Like this Karmapa is, I've met him 3 times, and I can tell you he's fully capable of whatever it is that he feels like he wants to do. And what he wants to do is save the earth literally from the environmental degradation that we're having. And all the energy goes there. He doesn't want it distracted by a magic show. And all the Karmapas are like that. So it's weird. You see these parts of the biographies when they're really young, they do stuff you don't believe a young person could do. And then they really get down to business and accomplish a tremendous amount. You can't believe how much. And we'll be going through that. So when he was 7 months old, he was heard reciting the litany of the names of the Buddhas. That's another liturgy of the 35 Buddhas and the 6-syllable mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Once again, Karmapas are identified with the Buddhas, and they're identified with the 6-syllable mantra, because that's really the name mantra of the Bodhisattva of compassion. One of the things that's interesting is that this lama who recognized him took he and his parents into his house. So he was actually living at a monastery from the time he was a couple months old, and he used to like to sit in this little chair. And because people thought he was a special child, they'd come by and he would put his hand on their head and bless them, just the way all these guys do, even when they're like much older. When he went to Karmagun eventually, he found the stone throne that the fifth Karmapa used to sit in, and then there was this little black crown, which is the hat of the Karmapas, and he went right for it as a little kid, and they said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, it's mine." And he said, "Don't you know I'm the reincarnation of Deshen Shekpa?" at which point they decided that they would actually check out this prediction letter and do the traditional identification of this guy, because I don't know if you've been to many monasteries, they like order. They don't like little kids running around doing whatever they feel like, right? So he got recognized at that point, and the prediction letter had been, they figured out what town he was from and what parents he was from, and that matched. And then they do this traditional thing where they put an array of the possessions of the previous Karmapa in front of him, along with an array of the possessions of other people and other high lamas and stuff, bells and malas and you name it, different stuff. And if the child identifies which ones are his without any error and spontaneously, without any coaching, they know they got the real guy. If, however, they make a mistake and they see something shiny that they like better, they know they don't have the real guy. And so he went through that and he was recognized. After that, even Karmapas have to go to school. Even though they have these innate qualities, they have to go to school, and that Tulku school, these are called Tulkus, reincarnated lamas, usually start at the age of 7 or 8, and they bestow novice vows on them, and the simple bodhisattva vow, and then they begin to learn the lineage. In this case, he was learning the lineage from a lineage holder named Ratnabhadra, who the fifth Karmapa had bestowed the lineage on. He met the first Trungpa Rinpoche, who was born at the time of the fifth Karmapa, who came, and as soon as he saw him, he said, "Do you have that protection cord I gave you?" And Trungpa Rinpoche was like shocked and said, "Yes." I've heard stories about this Karmapa from eyewitness, actually first person stories about this one doing similar stuff. We don't have enough time for all the stories, so I'll save them for another time. The important things that he got involved in, though, is, and this is really important, is that the Karmakaju, this lineage, is known as the practice lineage. It really came from Milarepa's meditation in the caves, passed on to Gampopa and so on. And so meditation was the core, and it is the core, and it's the foundation, and it's what we all have to do. But as a lineage, and as to have the structures to really train people well and give them the best chance of realization, he realized that there needed to be a little more structure. And so this Karmapa actually started to compose a number of the rituals that we still use. He composed sadhanas that we still use. He wrote music for the first time. He was the one who put a lot of this stuff to tune so it would be easier to do and easier to memorize and easier to learn. His whole thing was to find a way to share this so that more people could benefit, more people. It was all about that. And he also, there are things called lama dances. I don't know if any of you have seen them. They're not often done in this country, but there are some YouTubes out there. He was the one who created the first Ma Kala Lama dance, the Cham dance. And he wrote extensively on the preliminary practices, particularly for Vajrayogini and Chakrasamvara, so that those of us who want to enter the path, those are important deity practices in the Karmakaju, And, you know, instead of someone saying, just go meditate on them in a cave and see what happens, he figured out, here's a step-by-step way where we can develop our minds to really engage with these energies and with this spiritual kind of reality. So he was extraordinarily caring for us, and for us ordinary people who weren't necessarily born with a spiritual silver spoon in our mouth. He established a lot of places to reproduce texts. Now, you got to think of this. At that time, they did it all by hand. Everybody was writing all these things out. And you have to understand, in the Buddhist canon, there's something called the Kanjur, which are all the teachings of the Buddha, okay? And there are 108 volumes of the Kanjur, written, reproduced by hand. Monks doing this. And then there's the Tenjur, which is 225 volumes that go with it. And they have commentaries on the Kanjur, and they have the writings of the great Indian masters, including texts on grammar and architecture and poetics and astrology and astronomy. All the sciences, art and architecture is all in there. And then it came to Tibet. And in this time between then and when Buddhism first came to Tibet, there were, what does it say? It's some like crazy amount of texts, like 100,000. And they started to be reproduced and sent to the different monasteries, because the Karmakaju by that time had become the most popular, if you will, lineage in Tibet. It was the most populated, and he wanted everybody to have access to this. So they created something new, too, called woodblock printing, where they didn't have to write them all by hand, but somebody had to carve the text into a woodblock in relief, mirror image, so that it could be rolled with ink and, boom, printed. And each woodblock could do like, you know, a few thousand pieces of paper before it wore out, and it had to be done again. In this age of printers attached to our computers, this is mind-blowing to me. What these people did, and they did it literally for our benefit. Had they not done it, we might not be here this morning, literally. So he did all that, and then he continued what was called the Great Encampment. The Great Encampment was like traveling around all over Tibet so he could personally give teachings. It was about 100 tents. It was about 300 monks. And it had all the rules of the monastery. So it was like a monastery in tents. And they would go from place to place, and everybody had a job. It was a little like the circus. You go to town, all the tents go up like overnight. Well, they had that down. In the summer, they had cotton tents. In the winter, they had yak felt tents. So they take the yak fur and braid it and make felt out of it so they could stay warm. And everything that he did went to finding a way of making sure that the Dharma, which could help us pass beyond suffering, was available. And he had in his tent, which was in the middle and it was the biggest, and it had a shrine room and a small shrine room and living quarters and all kinds of things under one tent. They used to come, and he would do empowerments and blessings and all the stuff that Karmapas do. The camp was completely vegetarian. And all the monks strictly kept the monastic vows, which are called the Vinaya. Those are the original vows that Shakyamuni Buddha taught. It's very strict. So it became known as the encampment of white soup because they basically had barley and maybe some beans and stuff, and that's what they lived on. The other big thing about getting around back then were the bridges between. Tibet's kind of mountainous, you know. So there were bridges, and they were generally made out of rope and stuff, and you were at risk. Any of those ropes could break at any time. They were let's say with the weather conditions up there, impossible to maintain well and expensive. So there was this great bodhisattva named Tatsun Gyalpo who wrote the Chenrezig practice that we use to this day. He was also an engineer, and he was known as the bridge builder, and he developed engineering to build iron bridges. These were expensive, and generally warlords, they did have those. It wasn't all just monks and nice people. There were a lot of bandits and warlords and ne'er-do-wells running around Tibet at the time. That's why they traveled in the Great Encampment, because 300 monks were hard to attack. If the Karmapa would have been doing it with just a little stagecoach like we did in the Wild West, he would have had problems, because those bandits didn't really care who he was. Nah, they just wanted his gold or whatever he had. So he realized the Dharma couldn't spread very well if people couldn't get from one place to another with these texts that he was having printed. So Tatsun Gyalpo visited. He was a bit of a wild man. Some of the monks wanted to throw him out because he was acting in crazy ways. But the Karmapa recognized him and invited him in. And the way that he showed his monks that they needed to exercise some discernment was he asked Tatsun Gyalpo to give him teachings. So that's another thing that's important about the Karmapas. They're humble. They wanted teachings from everywhere. Lineages aren't narrow. It's not like, okay, we're Karmakaju, not Galupa, or Shambhala, or Nyingma, or Shakya. The lineage had shared with each other, and that's also out of their concern that we'd have as many opportunities as we could to grow. So he got Tatsun Gyalpo to build some more iron bridges, and he funded them by founding, get this, the Tibetan Opera. And it was all women at the beginning, and so it was called the Lamo Opera, and it would tour around Tibet, and people would pay to see them perform, and they'd use all the money to pay for the bridges. So I thought that was kind of cool. That, to me, is like way cooler than a baby sitting on the throne blessing people and saying, like, profound things. He said plenty of profound things, of course. He wrote a lot of texts and a lot of books and all that, and that's great. But he figured out a way to give a foundation to the Dharma and to spread the Dharma and make it available to everybody. He identified what's become known as the first Jaltsab Rinpoche, who is now, I forget which one we're on now, seventh maybe, something. And he became his heart son. He became the one that the Karmapa passed the lineage on to, along with a guy named Bengur Jampol Zangpo. These are both people on the lineage Tanka, so you can, they're all their pictures are up there. He passed away at 38 years old. He was young. And he knew he was going to pass away, so he left the prediction letter and all that kind of thing. One of the things that's important to understand about Karmapas, and it was from that first thing he said about, yeah, well, I don't have a beginning or an end or any names. They had a direct experience of their mind stream, of their life, as being like a river. You can't find the beginning of a river. Where is it? In the rain clouds? Where are they from? It's like, and then the river appears and the river has a name. Then it flows in the ocean. And what happens to the river's name? That's the idea of being beginningless and endless. And Karmapas, one of the realizations is they understood the interdependence, the limitlessness beyond names. So for us, it's like freaky that he got all that done, and there was way more that I didn't cover, and he passed away at 38. But it's what happens, and there are other reasons for that. The seventh Karmapa was named Chidrak Jamso. He was Karmapa from 1454 to 1506. He was born in the Wood Dog year. A lot of the baby stories are similar, so I won't get into that because we'll run out of time. By the time he was 12, though, he was writing Dharma texts for monasteries. And we know it's true because they're dated and he wrote them. You know, they've got his name on them. He also spent a lot of time with older monks correcting errors in philosophical interpretations. At 17 years old, he decided to go on retreat at a sacred mountain called Kawakarpo. And he was in strict retreat for 7 years. Then he returned to Karmagon Monastery, where he had a bunch of visions of Guru Rinpoche. And that was appropriate because he held both lineages, the Nyingma and the Kagyu. And a vision of in which Shakyamuni Buddha also appeared, followed by a forewarning that future conflicts in the country would require that the lineage head and his following seek a place of refuge. History has validated that vision. Two centuries later, conflict broke out across Tibet and forced the 10th Karmapa and a number of Tibetans to flee to eastern Tibet. It was pretty rough. The Karmapas were under attack. So the 7th Karmapa did some more transmission. He identified some more people he could make the complete transmission to. He realized he had to disseminate it more, because if bad times were coming, it couldn't just be one or two people that were holding the lineage anymore. Had to be more. So he set himself about that. And he not only supported the making of woodblocks and stuff, he created printing houses. And he, the greatest of which was at Serpu Monastery. He also traveled to Lhasa, where he saw the great universities of Drepung and Ganden, which were Gelugpa universities. And he was invited by the Dalai Lama of that time to teach there, and he taught there. And he learned how the university thing went. And he realized he could train a lot more people if he did university. So he came back to Serpu, and he established what became at that time the greatest university in Tibet at Serpu. These universities were pretty incredible. One of the main ways of learning is through debate. So, let's see, there's a good description of debate. And what happens is that every day after school, one monk would sit down and one monk would stand up, and they would challenge each other in a debate over the material they just witnessed. Through this method of doing this every day, it wasn't unusual for the best students to memorize like 100 texts while they were in school. A typical college education like that took 12 years. So that was a long time. And the best students got, in the Gelugpa lineage, Geshe degrees, and in the Karmakaju lineage, they were called Acharyas or Kempos. So Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, for instance, is one of those guys, even to this day. And I hope that you all get to meet him, because he's extraordinary. Let's see, where is this? All right. Two students face off, one seated and the other standing, alternating their roles. The standing student carries out a series of well-orchestrated movements. He thrusts the left foot forward, wraps his rosary around his left arm, brings it up to his shoulder in a wide gesture, and then suddenly claps his hands to deliver the question based on the text just studied. His seated interlocutor must respond on the spot without any hesitation. Further exchange is meant to refine the response and then ensue. The topics of these contests mostly concern the sutras of Mahayana Buddhism and their commentaries, the shastras. The current Dalai Lama, the 14th, declared, "Wit is an important part of these debates, and high merit is earned by turning your opponent's postulates into your own humorous advantage." So I got an example of a debate here. Here you go. This was a friend just actually wrote this. He probably made this up. I don't think it would really happen. Dorje, I'll ask you one more time. Does this snow exist? If you know any middle way Buddhism, the idea of what exists and doesn't exist is a big deal. Does this snow exist? Padma, not really. Dorje, aha, so it doesn't exist. Padma, no, you can't say that either. Dorje, are you telling me it neither exists nor doesn't exist? Not really. Dorje, then you are telling me it both exists and also doesn't exist. Padma, now that's saying the same thing backwards. Dorje, then WTF, man, what is this white stuff falling on my head? Padma, you could say it is waves rolling on the ocean of an empty mind. Dorje, you mean my mind is making this snow? Padma, no. Your mind is too busy parsing concepts to make snow. This snow is falling in the mind of that Kusalu, the simple meditator is a Kusalu, sitting at the back of the courtyard. So these things go on all the time, and actually it's like that. Also YouTubes of Tibetan debates on, and they're, even if you don't know Tibetan, it's just a blast to watch, because they're like, and they're just clapping their hands and pointing at each other, and it's a lot of fun. This Karmapa also was known to solve political problems. He did a lot of mediation. And he lived in a court for a long time where they would bring scholars in to try to solve political problems, because they were boiling up in Tibet at that time. there were warlords and they were fighting just like we still have today. And that's why guys like His Holiness the Karmapa and His Holiness Dalai Lama actually still try to engage as much as they can to negotiate better things than what are actually happening with politicians just banging their heads against each other. One of the things that moved me the most, because there's tension between the lineages, if you don't know that, someday you might encounter it. It's this one story that I want to read to you, and that'll be the end, because this happened near towards the end of his life. Chodrak Jamso invited the renowned Tertons, or treasure revealers, in the Nyingma tradition. Pema Lingpa, who was, there were five great treasure revealers. He was like the fourth, I think. From Bhutan, to meet him at the court of the Rimpung princes, where he was helping mediate these problems. On this occasion, the Tertan showed him the termas, the things he discovered, texts, pills, and prophecies, and declared that he had not shown the secret prophecies to anyone yet in order to avoid jealousy. This reminds me of why great beings like Karmapa don't do miracles all the time. They don't want to stir up negative emotions or false impressions of what's going on. They're wiser than that. He said, in fact, several people had spread rumors about the Tertan, accusing him of being a fraud. Pema Lingpa declared to the Karmapa, "Some say that I'm a charlatan, others say I'm an emanation of a demon. In my own mind, I believe that I accomplished the activities of Guru Rinpoche. Now, precious Lord, since you are omniscient Buddha, you must state clearly which of these I am." This is an important mediation. Things happen like this for all of us sometimes, and we tend to give direct answers, and they don't help much. Here's what Karmapa did. As an answer, and in order to show his great respect for the Tertan, the Karmapa requested that he bestow on him the entire cycle of his terma initiations and instructions. So the Karmapa, as an answer, said, "I want to become your student." To me, that moved me to tears. It's brilliant. And so it wasn't long after that that the Karmapa himself realized that he wouldn't live much longer. There was a new monk named Sanjay Nempa, who was a profound meditator and had gone on long retreat, and he invited him out of retreat. And he passed on to him the entire lineage, along with the fourth Sharmapa, the third Taisitu, and the second Jaltsa. So he expanded it to four because of that prophecy he'd received earlier that we had to get to work and make sure that these teachings found their way into the marrow of the bones of practitioners. And then he passed away. He was 53 years old. Also not that old. The texts that he left behind that are still studied today are mostly on the Vinaya, which are the strict vows that monks take, and Madhyamaka philosophy, which is like this debate right here, trying to ascertain the nature of reality, and the tantras, which are the ways that we meditate in order to see our own nature as Buddhists. So, I didn't leave much time for questions, but if anybody has one or two, we've got a couple of minutes.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify the person born in the year of the fire monkey was the sixth Karmapa?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Hey, Eric.
Hey, Arvin.
From the little study I've done of the, from the source of a lot of the practices we do, I know my understanding is, at least, is that there's been some like cross-cultural pollination or religious or ritualistic pollination between Buddhism, particularly Tibetan Buddhism, and like cross-cultural, cross-religious,
yeah,
cross-ritual,
sure,
pollination. And I wanted to know if there's any, just out of curiosity really more than anything else, because, I mean, you were talking about the seventh Karmapa, and I think he was responsible for documenting the Tantra, Tantric practices. I thought I heard you say
that. Well, he wrote about them, yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering if there's any, like, anything on either in these biographies or someplace else that talks about, you know, the influence. Like, because I think of, like, for instance, Green Tara. Green Tara, the original, like, stuff from Green Tara, I think, came from someplace in India or something. Like, they've, like, you know, the original part of the practice, or at least.
Well, here's the thing.
Right.
They were in that culture.
Right.
And the beauty of Buddhism in particular is that it doesn't have a lot of beliefs. There are really two things you got to believe. Right. One is that you have the same nature as the Buddha.
Sure.
You have enlightened nature.
Right.
It's a belief simply because if we saw it already, we'd be Buddhas already.
Right.
But and the other is a belief for the same reasons is an interdependence.
Right.
That everything you do matters.
Sure.
That isn't necessarily the fundamental belief foundation of the other tantric cultures in northern India, for instance.
Sure, of course.
So they had these expressions of, like, the expressions of male, masculine and feminine energy, for instance, are in all cultures and,
sure,
in all spiritual traditions.
Sure.
But the fundamental basis that you're doing these practices for might have different aspirations.
Right.
So they use some of the iconography.
Right.
For sure.
Sure.
And that's what most of these anthropological studies are tracing, is they're noticing the relationship of the iconography between,
sure,
one culture and another.
Sure.
But as Buddhists, the things that are important are our motivation and our aspiration.
Of course.
And that is different. And that was flowing, as far as I know, it hadn't really been articulated well.
Right.
Until Shakyamuni.
Right.
So that was the innovation, was the articulation of that.
Right.
And the fact that Zen people borrowed from Japanese culture,
sure, sure,
and Tibetan people got things from Northern Indian culture, no surprise.
Right.
And,
right,
you know, we're now seeing things that relate to Native American culture,
sure,
over here.
Right.
And great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So does that,
well,
answer
of
your
course,
question?
I mean, at the end of the day, what I mean, if I can summarize what you just said, you know, really at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, which I get. But the only reason I bring it up is because there were very specific things that you, when you were, you know, reading about this, there were very specific instances where things were kind of described or discussed. So I just,
well,
thought,
true. And here's the thing. These sadhanas, for instance.
Right.
even if the iconography is borrowed from some other culture, mm-hmm. The structure of them,
right,
the order of the prayers and just how the preliminaries go, mm-hmm. creation and completion, if sure. you will, in each case is a way for your mind to develop and loosen some tension and attachment. So you open and open and open further and further till the point where you recognize yourself as that Buddha.
Okay.
That's the whole idea.
Right.
So the issue really is with those specifics and what these Karmapas were doing when they'd write about Tantra.
Okay.
They were making sure you understood the path you could go down to most quickly realize that given your human mind.
Yeah.
Some of those practices, I'm pretty familiar with some of the practices of Northern India because of mm-hmm. my misspent youth. Some of them are to develop powers, and some of them are to develop this, or some of them are to attract a lover or whatever.
I'm still working on that one.
Okay. No, well, yeah. Okay. So these all are to recognize your Buddha nature and interdependence.
Right. Right.
So that's everything hinges on that.
Sure. Of course. I get that.
Yeah. So that's the difference between, say, a Kashmir Shaivite, I forget, the feminine energy that looks like Tara versus mm-hmm. the green Tara practice that actually, it might have been Pema Lingpa who discovered that as mm-hmm. a terma. If you look at that practice, mm-hmm. it has really specific things that you go through when you do it. Mm-hmm. And it's in order to bring you to that point.
Right. I think that for me, in asking, you know, getting up here and talking and asking the question and thinking about or having a better understanding of how this stuff kind of cross-pollinated or stewed,
yeah,
for lack of a better term, it helps me understand the dynamics of the history mm-hmm. and also the different lineages and that sort of thing.
Oh, it's,
and culturally, too, because just from like listening to you talk about how, you know, the expression of the value, the Buddhist values in the language, you know, and how it's, you know, prescribed or linked up with the different vowel sounds.
Yeah.
I mean, that just blew my mind. I was like, wow.
Yeah, I know. It's
right.
Well, so, they're and their practices that begin to involve that.
I mean, I'm thinking of the Guru Rinpoche mantra. Mm-hmm. I mean, right there, you know, and then I was like, oh, that's why that's in the Guru Rinpoche mantra.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a whole other discussion.
Right. But anyway, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Arvin. Well, we've run a little over. So as a dedication of merit, just please take a breath and relax. I'm going to read to you a prayer that I've added recently to all my dedications of merit. I want to share it with you. At this very moment, may the people and nations of this earth not even hear the words disease, famine, war, or suffering. May pure conduct, merit, wealth, and prosperity increase, and may supreme well-being and good fortune always arise. And we dedicate the merit of us getting together to hear about Karmapas to that. Soha. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.